Welcome to the Mindful Sobriety Podcast with your hosts, Jane and Amanda. I'm Jane, a licensed psychotherapist and alcohol-free retreat host.
And I'm Amanda, alcohol-free lifestyle coach and yoga instructor. We're so glad you're here.
Our guest today is Sweta Sansara. Sweta was born in Nepal and faced adversity with determination from a young age. Overcoming childhood trauma and addiction, she embraced sobriety at the age of 17. Breaking barriers, she became the first female Marine from Nepal and Hollywood actress, and now uses her platform to advocate for mental health and destigmatize therapy, especially in South Asian culture. As a devoted mother and wife, she founded the Nepal Youth Fund, empowering communities through education. Through her advocacy on Instagram, Sweta inspires hope and unity, reminding others that they're not alone in their journey toward healing. Her story embodies triumph, resilience, and a commitment to building a better world for all.
Thank you so much for joining Amanda and I today to share your story. We are so happy to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always an honor and a privilege to be able to share my story. And hopes to help others. So I'm happy to be here.
Yes, that's awesome. So you and I actually met over Instagram several months back. You reached out to me and we went live together and you interviewed me and asked me, you know, about my alcohol-free journey. And I'm so glad you did that because now, you know, I feel like we know each other. We comment on each other's posts and it's like this little community.
Yeah, definitely. You were one of the first people I reached out to when I opened up my account and decided to do this. You definitely have a lot of experience that you share that I related to, and I think it's wonderful what you're doing. So I'm glad to be here chatting with you now.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you. Well, maybe to start out, could you share with us just a little bit about your journey coming to this alcohol-free space and what that's been like for you?
Yeah, definitely. So, I actually coming up on 17 years of sobriety. So I've been around a while.
Yes, yeah. That is awesome.
So when I came into the sobriety space, it wasn't exactly, I feel, as popular as it is now. I was 23 years old. So a lot of the people around me here from the East Coast, I got sober on the West Coast, and they were all still out there partying and drinking and doing that whole thing. And so I chose to stay and create a community over there of sober people because I didn't really know much of many people who drank besides family members. And so that was easy for me then there, but I think that if I was starting here with the group of people and the family that's here, it would have been way more difficult for me.
Okay.
Because there was no, like, Instagram was not a thing back in Instagram came out in 2000. And so the way that social media is now, there wasn't any access to maybe I'll just jump online and grab some sober content and help me make it through the day, which I think would have been really helpful for me in my younger years.
Like, there weren't that many podcasts around back in those days.
No, it was, you know, 12-step programs and therapy, and you know, those were the options, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, those were the options that were given to me. And out of desperation, I took every option that came my way, and it worked for me for a really long time, and ebbs and flows and all of that. But yeah, so I think that then finding this space now, awesome, because it's opened my mind to many different ways that people get sober, and also just knowing that there is a community and a space in like the internet world that is so supportive and positive and caring. And I feel, you know, sometimes it can feel like exclusive, but it feels inclusive. This space feels inclusive, like many different types of social media spaces have a feeling. And I have been in my previous work that I was doing with gut health and all of that. There is like, you're either in this diet or you're not.
Yeah.
And you're either like, I just feel like everybody's just trying to share their story to help someone else. That's what it feels like, at least for me. So I am enjoying the space here. And I do have like my own physical world of silver space, people, environment that I've created, which for me is the most important space, is having those raw connections with people. And so those people I've met here on Instagram, I'm sure if we live closer, we'd probably get coffee.
Yes, we'd get together for sure. So you have a community of people who are local to you that you can spend time with and reach out to and who relate to your journey.
Yeah, I definitely do. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's so important. So 17 years ago, at the age of 23, what was the turning point for you where you said, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to take this countercultural approach to life and give up alcohol.
Well, it was a long time coming. I had tried many times to get sober. And well, I kind of have to go back because I lost everything. Everything to alcoholism. It runs in my family. I need to drink some water. I'm sorry.
Yes. Get the cops out.
I feel like we were up late last night for trivia night. It was my husband's birthday. And I was screaming a lot because.
A lot of competition.
It was loud. We were in a bar, which I can do today if I sleep. All right. So 17 years ago, I got sober because I couldn't stop drinking. I hit rock bottom. For me, that's my story. It was a rock bottom situation. I had lost everything. I had two boxes to my name. And I was in Colorado at the time. And I called my parents. I was going through a breakup with somebody who I thought I was going to be with forever. That kind of situation. And I had tried. I was sober for a year and I tried to stop. And then I was told to the person that I was with at the time that, oh, you don't really have a problem. Like, everybody gets blacked out drunk sometimes and it happens. Like, maybe he forgot that that was every time and I was ruining things and hurting people and physically hurting people and getting behind the wheel, just doing really destructive things.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm going to try again. I'll try again. And it was really hard. I started hiding. I started, you know, I needed more. When I had one, I needed more.
Right.
And so all of that ended. And I called my parents and I was like, we were breaking up. And, you know, my parents are so wonderful. And, yeah, I'm fortunate to have them. And they're like, well, what do you need us to do? And I was like, well, I want to go to Hollywood, you know, just I wanted to be an actress.
Yeah.
And so they're like, okay, come home for a little while. And they thought that I was going to classes and getting sober and doing all of this stuff because I told them that I had stopped drinking. So they wanted to help me.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would have gotten that same kind of help if they knew what was going on. And so I didn't tell them that I drank again or that I had been drinking so I could get the help that I needed because that's what I kind of person that I was at that time in my life. So I went home for a little bit. I processed. I couldn't stay at my parents' house because I was so depressed. I stayed at my uncle's house, basically in the basement for a week. I did what they asked me to do, and then I moved to California, and I drank again. And this time, it wasn't so bad, but it was enough for me to be like, I have a problem. Like, I really have a problem. And I met a cousin who was sober, and she was like, I know a place where you can go, and, you know, we got the hotline going and I got picked up and went to my first 12-step meeting on that November, what was that? March 16th, 2007. And I had started meeting people and I met a friend who was going through school to be an alcohol counselor, like a drug and alcohol counselor. And she had me move in to her house. She's like, you can't stay where you are. Like, you're welcome to, like, just all these angels. Like, earth angels started to come into my life. And I stayed with her for a year. And she was like, just go to therapy, do your thing, get sober. Like, you can stay with me. And
eventually,
she was
like, you've got to change your people, places, and things. And
exactly. All of it. And so, it was, I'm sorry. It was really hard, but I did it. I did it alone. Like, I didn't involve my parents. I didn't ask them for money, which is what I used to do. I used to just take and take and take and take and take. And I finally stopped doing that and learned to go back to school, learned how to job. I got back on my seat and I started acting. I did a lot of television, movies, all the things. And yeah, my life changed completely.
What was that like, being in like the acting Hollywood scene while also maintaining sobriety? Where did you find other sober people in that space?
There are a lot of sober Hollywood people.
Okay.
It's a thing.
Nice.
Yeah. And so my friends, they all had, you know, I had like all of a sudden connections to people that I didn't. You know, I had a friend whose father was like a huge manager. You know, Robin Williams, discovered Robin Williams. Wow. And Billy Crystal. And I had an opportunity to sit with him and get a lot of good, solid advice about, you know, like, did your career as doing, you know, if that was even something that I should be doing or whatever.
Yeah.
I like do know now that, what's that?
Kind of like a mentor.
Yeah. Well, I met with him twice, so I didn't see him all the time. It was twice. But yeah, he has stayed with me all these years because he did give me some really solid advice about what I should be doing versus what I was doing. And at the time, I think he might have been able to see that I was very much doing this for seeking love, like approval, and that one day so-and-so would see me on the cover of People magazine and all of a sudden I would be loved. And so I did like it. I did enjoy it, but my motive behind it was still very, it wasn't pure. It wasn't actually what I really truly wanted. Mm-hmm. So I mean, he basically told me, you should take your life story and I hope you're writing it down, because I've been in the Marine Corps and I'm the first of my, from my country, I was born in Nepal. I'm the first to join the Marine Corps, the armed forces, first female to join the armed forces in the history of my country. And
wow.
You know, there's just a lot in my background that, and then going into the Marines and, you know, my whole history, he told me to write it down and to continue to write it down for many years and then write a book and then put it out. And that's the kind of stuff all stories are made out of, because movies are made out of stories like yours. And that's what you should do.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, I don't like that answer, but I'm going to pocket that and keep on going.
But it's pretty inspiring, you know, like,
yeah,
you've got a story that mm-hmm. can impact other people, that can change lives.
Yeah. So that is now, I feel like that's where I'm at in my life, where I am in the process of chapter one. And I have all of the, I kept journals, I did everything he told me to do. He's passed away a few years ago, but I'm still in touch with his daughter, who got, you know, she's a friend of mine. And I haven't told her this. We haven't talked, like, we don't talk often, but when mm-hmm. we do, it's pretty short and like, hey, how are you? But more recently, I've been having dreams about her and I reached out to her. And so when we do finally have our next conversation, I'm going to tell her, hey, you know, your dad told me this, and sure, it'd be a special moment because she's a special girl and she's sober like me. And we have a very deep, beautiful, wonderful, amazing connection. So
yeah. Yeah. Sobriety tends to do that with people when you've got that in common.
Yeah. Yeah. So, the camaraderie is right away the most incredible, like in the Marine Corps, when you see another Marine, or even when you have just gone through the process of boot camp, there's nothing like it. You can't, the camaraderie that you get with your platoon or those people, it's like, I can't even describe it. It feels the same way with people whom I meet for the first time who are sober.
Yeah.
I mean, they might have a different story and a different journey, but there's a reason why they're choosing not to drink. And usually if I'm at a party, those people will be find each other.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's like you get each other on another level.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about the Marines. When was that, before you got sober?
Oh, yes. So yes, it was before I got sober. And I was going to the University of Maryland. And I had been drinking a lot, naturally. I was that girl all through high school with the drinking and all the things. And I had a little bit more freedom now that I was in college. And I couldn't stop drinking. I wasn't showing up to my classes. I was failing. And I guess my report card had come home. And I was living with my parents at the time. I guess my report card had come home or something like that, and they just saw everything, and I was selling everything. And I didn't know this then. I know this now looking back, that my parents and my sister, my older sister, were probably sitting around talking about, like, what should we do with her? Like, we, you know, having conversations about me.
They were concerned. And
very concerned. I mean, and then my parents were really strict. So I wasn't really allowed to go out and do things. So I would just ignore their calls when they would call me, and they would have to call the police to come find me because X, Y, and Z, fill in the blank. I mean, it was a disaster. I was a roaring tornado, definitely, in my drinking and in my teenage years and early adulthood. So I came home one night from a party, and actually drugs are a part of my story. I definitely engaged in drugs. I had eaten some mushrooms, and I thought at that time I should probably drive home now, which is, you know, normally I'm like, I'm staying out and I would drive drunk. Like, I am very ashamed to say that, but I did. That's what my, where my drinking took me. But this particular day I decided to come home. And it was about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had taken them, and I knew that it was going to hit me and that, like, I really wouldn't be able to drive. I might have a panic attack or something. So I came home, and the sister was sitting up, but because I was on drugs, I felt like it was kind of like 7 p.m. at night, and like, oh, my sister, like, she wants to talk to me. Like, this is a bonding. Like, I was feeling like it was something that it wasn't.
Yeah.
Because clearly she was sitting there waiting up for me.
Yes.
And I sat down. And we started talking. I was like, oh, this is so nice. Because we didn't have conversations like this. Because I was really disassociated from life and in my drinking. And she said, you know, what do you think about the military? And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, that sounds like, you know, so-and-so. She was going on about something. I was like, oh, that's nice. And she said, well, what do you think about it? And I was like, well, I don't know. She's like, you want to go check out? And again, I'm on drugs. You want to go check out some of these, you know, Army, Navy, the military. I said, sure, we can go to some of the recruiting offices. And she'll go, okay, I'll wake you up in the morning and we'll go. I didn't sleep that night. And to me, it was like we were going to go do something together. Like, we didn't do that. Yeah. And so it felt like something special was happening. But again, I'm on drugs. And I go in to my bedroom. I didn't sleep that night because I was on drugs and I was doing whatever. I was coloring and listening Pink Floyd and being the hippie that I was.
Yes.
And I, 6 a.m., my sister knocks on the door. So, I mean, this is like serious business. She went to sleep. She's thinking normal. First thing in the morning, we're not getting up and her changing her mind. Like, we're going. She takes me and I am seeing colors. I'm like full on. So we sit in the Army, didn't like it. We sit in the Navy, didn't like those colors. And then the guy goes, I mean, it was all about colors because I was on, like, this is
on a psychedelic substance.
I'm on psychedelics. And so I'm like, oh, and I'm having this experience with my sister. And I'm like, this is like special.
We're bonding
here. And then, yeah, it's like, the guy at the Navy, I remember very clearly him saying, well, you know, the Marine Corps is, they say that they're the best fighting force, but they're nothing without us. And I was like, what's the Marine Corps? I'd never heard of it. So we go to the Marine Corps office, which is always in the back and hidden because that's how it is with the Marine Corps. It's like always you got to go the extra mile for it. And I went back there and I was hit with these blues and these reds and the flag. I like this. And they told me they could put me in Camp Pendleton and that they're like, what do you want to do? I was like, I want to be an actress. And they're like, okay. We can make that happen. And I was the last person they needed to make their quota for the month. They needed one person to make that recruitment.
Yeah, their goal.
To fill that recruitment. And so we can put you here and we can station you there. And then you can drive up to LA and you can do all this. And we'll make you, they have this special admin that they were like, we're going to give you this job. It's called a zero blah, blah, blah. Because everything's in numbers. And so the jobs are like, they're listed in numbers. I'm like, oh, this sounds great. Signed. And 3 days later, I think it was, I came to on the yellow footprints. I don't know what I, like, it was a blur because they're like, this is it. The moment I signed, it became what is called a pulley.
Okay.
Like, they are training you and you're you are going to be going to this thing. And, but the thing that they said to me more than the actress thing that got me is they said, we will strip you down of who you are and make you into the most courageous, the bravest woman you could ever possibly be. And not only did I hear they'll strip me down and turn me into a different person, because I didn't like who I was at all. The self-loathing was like, I mean, that's what I lived in. It's what I drank over, is to just wash away all this.
Yeah.
And that was like the number one reason. And because I had so many eating disorder issues with body image and all of that is part of my history. Mm-hmm. As if they're going to change me, not only are they going to make me thin equals love, because that's the message I received early on in my life.
Uh-huh.
Thin equals love. So you'll be thin and you'll be a different person. Oh, I'm in. And you'll get to be an actress. Oh, I'm in. They will beat it into me. I need to be in the number one fighting force where they're going to beat me into being somebody else. And that's what I thought was going to happen.
Actress.
Oh, yeah. Actress. I mean, I'm still to this day cannot believe that, like, I was on drugs, so there's that, but like that I did that.
Yes.
So they put me through, because I was a little bit overweight at the time, they needed me to lose 5 pounds in 3 days and to get me on this next plane to get to Paris Island. And so they said, from here on out, you can't eat.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, here we go. Yes, let's
do it. Your eating disorder voice is like, all right, we got this.
Yes, we're in. Here we go. And so I remember them taking me to a Marine Corps base, and they had a recruiter with me, and they gave me the Hollywood juice people used to drink? It was a Hollywood juice that was basically a laxative called the Hollywood diet.
Oh my gosh, this must not have made it to Texas.
They three bottles of that.
Oh my God.
Running on the track. I had saran wrap around me. Sweats, they had me running. And I'm still like, this is the moment like after I signed. Like now I'm theirs. And so I'm like, okay, they're good. This is it. This is how I'm going to get thin. I'm going to get loved. I'm going to go to Hollywood. Like this is it. And because I didn't eat, because I wasn't properly fed and all of that, I did make the requirement. They did drug test me and they had to pull some strings around that whole thing because I popped for, shrooms and marijuana.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was crazy. I lied to them. They put me behind. I remember standing behind a dumpster and this huge Marine, huge. She's like, why did you lied to us? Like, oh, I was terrified. But I was like, this is it. They're starting to change me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm sorry, but like, reprogramming has started. Let's go. And, you know, anyway, I got through that. I lost exactly the three. I think it was 3 pounds or so, 2 or 3 pounds. I had to lose a certain very low amount of weight in order to make it because I was right about the max. And I made it. I got in. And that's when I came to on the yellow. Like, I was like, oh, we are here and we are on a yellow footprints. And that was it. There's no turning back then. And all through boot camp, I had that same, they're going to change me, change me, change me, change me, change me, never change. Got out. I was sober because I was in boot camp.
Yeah.
And yeah, I got out. I was like, okay, I can play this game. This is a game. I just have to get through this game. I get it. I know what this is. I get it. And so I played the game, got through. And the moment my parents picked me up, I had them stop at the PX. And this is the first time I actually had a full on like binge in front of my parents in the car. And it's not a pretty sight when I was in a binge. And Christy, who my parents were like, what are you doing? He's like, well, you don't know what it's like to only eat one apple. And I was devastated because I really didn't lose that much. I was just probably in normal size. I don't think I was ever big. I think that I just had this mentality that I need to be like Kate Moss.
Well, and if you're wanting to be an actress in Hollywood, you're probably thinking I need to be like a size 00 or whatever.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And so I got out and then I had leave for 10 days. So I went home and I was like, my parents, because it's 3 days that I was from the time I joined to the time, the last time I saw my friends was the day I took those shrooms, and I was drinking and I took those shrooms. So nobody had heard from me. They were calling my house. My parents were like, those are bad people. Like, they were telling me that I wasn't here, that I had left the country.
They're like,
that
I was gone. Rid of those friends.
So then I came home and I was like, I'm going to go out to eat. Really, I knew where my friends were. They were at happy hour. At Chili's happy hour. That's where they went on that day. And so I went there. They're like, where have you been? And I pulled out my dog tags and they're like, no way. Like, we're probably declaring war in the next 3 weeks. And you went into a nuclear war? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, that's so typical of you. You know, like, I was crazy. Like, that's like the kinds of things that I did. And
is this when we were over, like, the Afghanistan?
Yeah, they declared war right when I got into my on-job training unit at 29 Palms. And get this, I get out of boot camp, I do my leave, I go to Camp Lejeune, and then you go through war training.
Okay.
And it's like this whole situation that happens for a month. And it's freezing cold, and it's like you're in a war. And for us, it's like barren cold.
Yeah.
At the end of that, we're sitting and we're waiting to get what our job stations are. And I get called up, and they, you know, my last name before I got married was Lami Chane. And they're like, oh, and they called me Lima Charlie. Lima Charlie, in field radio operator, you have a 0.3 lifespan in war. You're with the grunts. I was not going to California. I was not going to be an admin. So I went up to him and I go, I'm sorry, sir. You know, I'm supposed to be doing this admin work to like help with Camp Pendleton. And then I'll be going to do auditions and stuff. And he looked at me and laughed so hard. That followed me my whole Marine career. I was 2 years in. I was doing, you know, I worked with the grunts. I shot machine guns, and I'm that person that holds them, you know, holding the machine guns, those big tanks that can drag those things. Like,
oh,
I was out
gosh.
There training with grunts, 65 guys. And he laughed so, and then I got stationed. Eventually I was in Camp Pendleton, and I had a gunnery sergeant. We were out in the motor pool where all those big vehicles are, because I drove those two. And the 7 tons. And he calls me and he goes, lunch, I get in here right now. Get in. And he's like, please don't tell me that you're doing rig. We think you're going to be a rig. And I was like, yes, sir, I did. And he was like, get out of my face. Like, it just followed me. And the drinking, of course, was, I mean, I drank at work. I drank every day. I had either beers on me, I had liquor on me. I drank every day.
You're trying to survive.
When I was in, yes. And it was not easy being in the Marine Corps for me at all.
And one of the only women, too, like that would be hard.
So we were split up. Girls and boys, like our barracks. So I did have a couple of girls with me, but there was the four of us, and we were in different sections. So we weren't with each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we experienced where one of the girls had, I mean, it was really hard. One of the girls got raped by another Marine who basically got away with it because he was a male who was reenlisting, and we were in wartime. So she, you know, basically got crying wolf and all of this stuff, which wasn't, it happened to her. So there's a lot of things that happened in the Marine Corps that, you know, eventually added to the PTSD that I already had.
Yes.
And the drinking, excuse me, the drinking definitely got worse as a result of everything that I experienced there. The sexual harassment, I used to wear a huge fake ring on my finger to hope, like, keep
people
guys away, because they're, you know, it was hard. You would just be walking places or you would get pinched on the butt, or, you know, they just
catcalled and in your story of being recruited, it's like you were lied to and manipulated and body shamed and basically tortured, drinking a laxative and then running around in sweats and plastic wrap on your body and then weighed, and like how degrading and painful and humiliating.
They weighed you pretty much every day. And I was in what When I got out of boot camp, they put me in a Porky Pig platoon and ran me twice a day.
Like, what does Porky Pig platoon mean?
Porky Pig is the pigs.
Like the people that need to lose weight.
And wow. Nobody was really overweight. We might have been like maybe 1 or 2 pounds over their max, which is different than normal, you know. And I don't know that I was even overweight.
Yeah. But I would think that for someone, I heard you, one of your videos on YouTube, you talked about then equals love, then equals friends, then equals everything. And so already having that mindset from a young age and then being told, put in the Porky pen, I mean, that had to feel really shameful.
Yeah, I think that the Marine Corps validated a lot of the thoughts that I had through the actions that they, you know, were taking about needing to be fit. Mm-hmm. And they were just like, you need to be fit. But in my case, yeah, I thought that, yeah. And for me, it was like, yes, okay, we're going to continue to try to lose weight. And it was all about losing weight. It got so bad. I blacked out one day at work and they found me in the parking lot. And then they were like, okay, you need to go in for therapy. And I was put on antidepressants and things like that, which I ended up, thank God, got off of, because I was drinking with the antidepressants. I was like, I don't know if I should take these. Like, I'd rather take the alcohol. But like, I think that at least I had some sense. Like, I think that they'll, if I mix these two, I'll definitely
interaction.
Yeah, like it'll definitely take my life. And I think that at that time, like, I had hope that I was still going to be thin. And this idea of like this thin Hollywood woman actress that one day would just be loved, because now I have this whole, you know, this whole idea of fame, was, it drove me. It was like this vision that just drove me for everything. And I still thought that I could attain that, but in a very destructive way. And I didn't know how to go about any way of doing anything in a healthy way, because in the end, I just didn't want to be here. But I was hoping that maybe I could get to that point of where somebody just, they loved me.
And I think, like, then also equaling success. Like, if I can just be thin, then I'm successful, because if anything else goes wrong, at least I'm thin.
Yep.
And that's my whole life mission, is to be thin. So that makes complete sense. And I think a lot more people are struggling with this and think about it than we realize, for sure.
Oh, I see it all the time in my friends. Mm-hmm. The things that they say. I have to say now, healing and recovery and putting those ideas away and replacing them with ideas of, I am perfect the way that I am and I am lovable, and really learning to love me and exploring who I am as a person and allowing that to shine, which has taken a long time to do. Through that process of like really getting over that idea of thin is, does it creep up sometimes? It does. It still creeps up sometimes. It's like, it's still there, but it's small. It's a small voice that I know how to handle. And as a result of that kind of love and relaxation of my nervous system and all of that, I am a size zero today. But I didn't do it in this way that it, you know, it's not like, I don't even care about that anymore. It's not the forefront of my life, but it just, I feel like the healing and the recovery took me somewhere that I desired to be once, but now I am, and it doesn't do anything for me. I don't feel that feeling that I thought I was gonna feel, like, oh, I have arrived, because it's not at all arriving at that, you know, tiny place. It's about really finding love for myself and then my body going naturally to where it's supposed to be, because I'm not harming it.
It's almost like
I naturally got there.
It's a side effect of loving yourself and living a life that is balanced and aligns with your values. You're not putting substances or food that is just numbing emotion.
Yeah, I mean, and then the cycle stopped. Like, the cycle of, for me, I would, one, part of my story I didn't tell you about right before the Marine Corps. And I think this was the tipping point. Well, it was the tipping point for my family to, I think, have this conversation and this whole Marine Corps thing came about. There was a night where I went out. It was just a normal Friday night. I was living with my parents. I was going to University of Maryland, and I was feeling, you know, feeling fat, and which I know is not a feeling anymore. It's a thought. And I was like, you know what? Today's going to be the last day that I have a binge. I'm going to binge today, and then tomorrow I'll start fresh, and this is it. So what I decided was I would go out to you know, this restaurant, and I ordered a lot of food, and I took it in the car, and then I had a fake ID, so I went to the liquor store that sold to the fake ID people, and I bought a cheap bottle of vodka, and I thought, okay, I'll just eat this, and I'll drink this, and I'll throw it up. Done. Last binge, start tomorrow. This is very, this is the first time I ever did something like that, but like, this diet and this starting a diet tomorrow was a very typical thing for me,
which brings on like the Last Supper mentality of I've got to eat everything now because I'm never going to eat this ever again. So I'm going to get it all in.
I got to get it in today.
Yeah.
So I ate all the food. I went up to my room. I was playing Nirvana at the time, and I was about 18 years old, maybe about to turn 19, and I started to, I was like, okay, you should be growing up here soon. You know, I'd never done this before. And along the way, I was like, you know what? I don't really want to be here anymore. So I'm just going to finish this whole entire bottle and hope I don't wake up. And so I guess I at some point, I blacked out, but I wrote a note, a goodbye letter to my family. And I don't know how much time had passed or what, but at some point, my parents came home and everybody was sleeping. And I don't remember any of this, but I must have gotten up. Oh, I did. I got up and I took this. I folded it up. You know, we used to write these letters in high school, you remember? And fold them in those little triangles. And I slid it under my parents' door. And I don't remember any of this. But apparently, so my dad woke up in the morning, early in the morning. And he said that as soon as he opened his eyes, the first thing he saw was a tiny little, like, piece of paper folded up in the corner, and he decided to get up and go see what it was. And he opened it up, and he said that, you know, it was saying goodbye. It was a goodbye letter, and that I was leaving, and I'm sorry, and all the things. And so my sister, he went to my sister's room, and he said, I can't open that door. You got to open it. I don't know if I can handle what's in there. So she showed her the note, and she goes in, and they called 911 and all of that. And the ambulance came, and they said that if they hadn't found me, when they found me, I would have died. And so they took me.
Terrifying.
Yes. Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Punched my stomach. And I remember coming to in the hospital, and then they put me in a lockdown facility for 2 weeks. And I don't remember much of that place, but I remember just crying. I was sitting on the bed where the doctor was checking me. And this was like a few days into being at this lockdown facility. And my mom came, and we're sitting there, and I was like bawling. And I was like, you've got to put a towel over that mirror. She was like, why? I was like, I can't stand looking at myself. I hate myself. You stand in front of that mirror. Like, I was yelling at her, don't let me see that ever again. And, you know, I don't think I've ever shared that out loud, that memory. It's very clear to me. And I didn't have clothes on. I just had the little sheet thing. And I stood up and I opened. I was like, look at this. Look at this. This is disgusting. And I closed it.
Just that self-loathing is it's so painful.
And to think that that is, like, today when I get out of the shower, I'm like, I've been tired. It's just wonderful. Like, I don't think that way anymore. I'm like, this is the body you always dream. You already have, the dream that you had is actually real. Like, you are in a beautiful, healthy, almost 41-year-old body. And, you know, I have a different perspective around, you know, the parts that I hated of myself. My children came into my light. And I remember nursing my son, and he was old enough to like hold onto my arms. And I used to hate my arms. Oh my God, I hate it. And I would dream of cutting them out, like cutting, just shitting. And he would just, the way he loved that part of my arm, I said, it was made for you.
Little tiny baby hand.
It was made for you. And all those little parts of me that I've ever thought that I've hated, my kids or my husband or my children have said to me, Mommy, I love this, you know, or my son always like had this weird fascination with my belly. And he just wanted to be close. And I was like, wow, like every part of me has a purpose. Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel about my body today. Like my fingers, my toes, like everything is here to support my spirit to be something special because I am something special. And just to think that like I haven't said that out loud. This is the first time I've ever said that memory out loud. And I'm sure my mom probably still remembers it. You know, we don't really talk about that stuff, so.
Yeah, it's probably painful to go back and remember, but it's almost miraculous to hear of what your life was like and how much pain you were in and then where you are today. You know, it's like the best ending that anyone could imagine for that young version of yourself.
Absolutely.
And just what a gift.
Yeah, it's, and I have my whole like life experience today is I want to live every day that when I hope to be here for as long as I possibly can, which is so different than what that girl
wanted.
Yes, on my deathbed, like the day that is my time to leave this body, I just want to be like my best. I want it to feel like we are such good friends. And I feel like if that were to be today, I would feel like that. It'd be like, we had so much fun. Like all of it, we conquered it. We did it. And we got to a place where like I did this with me, with her, with my part, with those, you know, it's a we.
Yes.
And that's how I feel like I live my life. Me and her, mm-hmm. like higher self, however you want to put it. But like, really? I'm with somebody. Like it feels like my spirit has taken over my body and I'm living with this human creation that's just incredible, and we're moving through this together with all the little bits and crevices, and I aim to live in those tiny crevices of life, like the moments of taking the moments to like watch my kids do something that most people would think is just a meaningless everyday thing, to just be in it, melt in it. And so I have all these memories of things with my kids, and I tell myself, if you forget those memories, just remember that you were in them. You were in it. You were in it. You were so in it. You lived every inch of your life fully.
Yes.
After you got sober. But after I got sober, that's what my life turned into, like moment by moment. And the gratitude that I have today, it's profound. It's in so many moments. I thought like, oh, you just get gratitude sometimes. No, I feel it in massive waves throughout my day. Because I think that I invited in, but I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy that I'm alive and that I get to be here, because I certainly, there was moments of my life that I could have easily slipped away.
I mean, that's so beautiful. And that part of you that you described, like that spirit, that's been with you since the day you were born. And that's what kept that young college age version of you going. And I think part of healing from trauma is integrating that girl into who you are today. Like, you're not ashamed of her. She's not bad. She was suffering and she was doing whatever she could to survive with the resources that she had at the time. And your love and acceptance for her and integration of her into you is such an important part of healing.
Yeah. I am interested. I know that you, or I think that you are pretty much sugar-free. Like, I'm interested to hear what a day in your life looks like as far as what you food intake goes.
So I typically, I wake up and I have breakfast right away because that's something I skipped for years. Years. I have eggs, typically boiled eggs, soft boiled eggs, one or two, depending on my exercise that day. Half an avocado. So like today, I had half an avocado and I had a cup of coffee with half and half. And I can have very specific, like monk fruit sweetener, which I don't have all the time, but sometimes I do have some of that in my coffee. Like this morning I did. And then I made fresh chicken parm with batch cook. So because it's my husband's birthday, I made but trays of chicken parm. And I usually make those in a way that I didn't have them. So they don't have certain takes of added sugars and things like that in it that might create a trigger for me. Because when sugar enters my body, what happens is it's basically like alcohol. I have this craving that I can't stop. And then it's like, oh, I need more. I need more. I need more. And I'll quickly go into the story of what happened to me when I ate too much sugar once. This is when I found out that I actually had a physical reaction to sugar. I ate a lot of candy one day at work. I blacked out completely. I forgot my lunch and I was running the place from breakfast to lunch. It was February where all of the girls were bringing in the stuff that their boyfriends, and I was single at the time. And I was like, okay, I'll just eat this and we're good. I blacked out, went home. My mom was like, something's wrong with you. I was like, I don't remember anything. I drove home, locked up the store, locked up the facility, didn't remember anything. Called the doctor, went in for some blood work, and she said, did you drink last night? And at the time, I said, I have 4 years sober. I was like, I'm sober. Like, you know that I don't drink. She's like, nope, your liver enzymes are showing that you have had at least a pint of vodka. And I was like, no, I eat sugar all day. She was like, oh, well, it has the same effect on you as alcohol will on your liver. And if you do have it, be very careful. And so once I start, I can't stop. And so then I end up, and so when I was in my binge career, like doing that whole binge eating thing with sugar, I would be driving in the streets like, this is my last day, this is my last day, like a heroin addict waiting, getting that last fix. And when it got really bad, I was doing that almost every night. And then I would go home and I didn't know this, that I was binging on all that sugar. And then at some point I would pass out and I probably blacked out. And so it has a very bad effect on me and I just don't have it. So like, but go back. So I think like protein and a lot of veggies on occasion, depending on where it comes from, because I do have ulcerative colitis that I have healed through learning about pesticides and all of the way that our food is grown. And so if I do have fruits and things like that, I usually eat them seasonally and I will get them from the, like, my mother-in-law is an amazing master gardener, so she has this whole fruits and potatoes and everything. You name it, she grows it.
Wow.
And so when the blueberries are in season, I'm in her blueberry bushes, making thousands and thousands and thousands of blueberries. I'll freeze them, and I'll have blueberries until her blueberries are gone. But I won't typically go out to the store because I've done a test on my gut before with certain things and I end up having severe reaction to ulcerative colitis. If I go to other countries, they don't have it so bad, so I can get away with eating other things because over there they don't use some of the same things they use here. It's illegal. And that's a whole other topic for another day. It's so, as much as I love to eat certain things, I have to be careful because of that as well. So I try to keep it to certain types of, also oxalates affect me in a certain way. And
when I eat, oxalates, is that a type of preservative or?
Oxalates are found in fruits and vegetables. So for instance, I was looking to go vegetarian for a very long time because I thought that's what was going to heal me. And so I took out meat and I was like, I'm going to get protein and things like that from like spinach and iron from spinach, all the stuff that I can get, typically get from meat, I can get from these certain vegetables, kale and all that. And I was eating a lot of that. And so basically when you cut a plant, like certain plants, they release something called oxalates and some more than others. So spinach has a high amount of oxalates, which is they're basically the plant's defense mechanism. they spew out these crystals that are like shards of us, basically. Okay. So when I was eating a lot of spinach, I was having bleeding like you wouldn't believe, internal bleeding like you wouldn't believe. And when I stopped eating high oxalate veggies, I went into a deeper remission. So I don't eat spinach. I don't eat a lot of like low oxalate veggies, which is going to be, you know, broccoli. And of course, I had to cook a lot of this stuff down. My acupuncturist was like, always cook it down, always cook it down. So broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, you know, bib lettuce, regular lettuce. Lettuce is very low as well. It's so like
you figured out how to kind of work around it, which is great because with ulcerative colitis, I mean, you could be going in and getting infusions every 8 weeks or something.
I don't have to do any of that. They told me I would probably have my colon removed when I got diagnosed, that at some point I would have to have like surgery. And that it was very severe and the likelihood of with my whole history and everything that I probably wouldn't be able to have kids and all of that. And I got sober and I said nope to all of it.
That's awesome.
Where that?
So as a sugar-free person, is that something that you have cravings for? Or is it kind of once your body has normalized not having it, you just don't really think about it?
It's like alcohol.
Okay.
I don't care for alcohol. I can be around. I mean, I was at a bar last night. I could care less. I'm the most hydrated person in the room. It's the same thing. Cakes, cookies. In the beginning, it was very hard.
Yeah.
It was harder than not drinking.
I think it'd be harder for me than not drinking.
Way harder than not drinking because Christmas comes around and it's like,
yeah, my birthday is tomorrow. And I'm like, okay, what kind of cake do I want?
Yeah.
I'm going to have leftover cake. And,
well, and then there's ways around. So, like, I do have other options. Like, I do make, I'll do, like, an almond flour-based, you know, cake with certain things, you know, like, and I will use monk fruit sweetener. And I have made before, I made a red velvet cake once for somebody, and they couldn't tell the difference that it wasn't white flour.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there are times where I can, but it's sugar that I can't have.
Yeah. That makes like that refined white sugar.
Yeah. It's like really, you know, like if I accidentally get a little bit of honey in something, it's not going to affect me. But I choose not to because I have also been known to not be feeling great and then think that I can just drink a jar of honey because it's sweet.
Yeah.
So,
well, we're going to have you on again and hear more about the sugar aspect. This is really interesting. And I think a lot of people in the early stages of living alcohol-free and the not so early stages too, struggle with finding balance with sugar or figuring out kind of how to address sugar cravings.
Yeah. I think that too, what my doctor told me was that sometimes people who have, so when you have alcoholism, this enzyme thing happens in your, I mean, it happens to people anyway, but like the amount that you see is different than someone who it doesn't have alcoholism.
Yeah. Who is, or I guess is biologically predisposed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was telling me that and she was like, and so some people like you also have this with sugar.
Interesting. I would and love to learn is, more about that.
Yeah. And I mean, we could go on, we could do a whole nother thing just on that specific topic because I have a lot of experience around like that. And then also the way that it feels in your body as a drug. Like to me, and I think Time Magazine in like 2014 came out that's, you know, I'll never forget seeing the cover of it. They had a whole pile of sugar and they were comparing it to cocaine.
Wow.
And now they compare it to heroin.
And I bet if you looked at brain imaging, like the dopamine response and everything that lights up is very, very similar.
It is. They have them. They have them all. It's all there.
It's all there.
It's all there. And it's, And it's highly accepted. And when you don't eat a piece of cake, it's very different than saying no to a drink.
It is. People get it.
It's very different.
But if you're like, oh, I'm not having birthday cake. They're like, come on, party pooper.
Yeah. Just a small bite. It's not going to hurt you. Like, I'm like, no, it is.
It might.
I'm good.
I think it might. So.
Yeah. But I have a lot of tips and tricks around like how I get around. I usually will bring something.
Yeah.
That's
always worry something, because then it's like, oh, I'm having this too. Yeah. Or I've even been known to put it on my plate if I'm at somewhere where I know it's like that one person that really has a hard time. And I shouldn't have to do this, but sometimes it's just
sometimes
easier.
It's easier for you to not have to talk about it. And
then I just toss it.
Yeah.
But most people in my life, like the people that are in my life that I see regularly, I'm like, I don't need that. And either they'll ask me and I'll tell them. And if they're okay with it, we might hang out again. And if they're not,
you might have to set a different boundary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's just been such a delight talking with you and getting to hear your story and just the growth that is present in those 17 years is so inspiring to me, and I'm sure to so many other people. How can people connect with you on social media if they're interested in, you know, more of your content and more of the conversation that you've been having?
Well, I'm definitely on Instagram, and if you go to my Instagram, that'll take you to my YouTube channel. And for now, those are my two platforms. Okay. And I'm just happy to share my experience. And also a lot of part of my journey, which we didn't like go into, is then therapy, tons and tons of therapy.
Okay.
So that has been a game changer for me, which I just wanted to insert there because I didn't really touch on that. But the reason I think the way that I think today is because someone that was a professional held my hand.
Yeah. Guided you along that path. Well, maybe we need to have a part two to get more into your therapy journey and more of just kind of your current life today.
Yeah, I would love that. Anytime. Happy to share.
All right. Well, thanks again. And we will talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you so much for listening. We truly value each one of you. In support of the podcast, please follow or subscribe to the Mindful Sobriety Podcast.
We'd love to connect with you via Instagram at Jane W. Ballard and or DFW Yoga Girl. Sending you love and light.